Well, good morning, Paul. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for making the effort to be with us today. Small in number though we are, we've got some interesting information to share with you, and I'm sure the day is going to turn out really good. I'm going to just do three very quick book reviews. I think Greg does this pretty well every time he speaks, and I like the idea. Here's a book that's maybe interesting to most of us, Life Without Church. It's getting easier to imagine, or this is called Life After Church. Maybe you've already left. A leaver then. One among a growing number of them. Committed to Jesus, but not to an institution. Whether Sunday mornings find you alone in a one-bedroom apartment or isolated in a church of thousands, this author calls for you to one unifying task. Reform the church that belongs to Christ. Be the church from the inside out or the outside in. And some very challenging material in here. God's call to disillusioned Christians. Now my discussion today is really a part two, actually, carrying on from the last one that I did up in our hall where we did Blood Brothers in Conflict. And today we're going to be looking at one of the reasons why there is so much conflict in the Middle East. And we're going to be looking at Muhammad, whom I've titled the Locust Prophet. And of course, does anybody know how many Muslims there are in the world? Sorry? That's it, yep, 1.5 billion and growing. And a couple of really, really compelling books that I've read recently on the life of a Muslim, and especially for the Muslim women. This one here is the life story of Ayan Hirsi Ali, who was born in Ethiopia in a... Yeah, I know, I'm just choked up. Just in really, really bad conditions and, you know, really backward people. And at a very young age, she endured female genital mutilation and grew up thinking that was normal, and that's what happened to all little girls. And she eventually found her way to Holland. And in Holland, she was accepted as a normal person, not just as one of the dogs. I mean, they treat their women like dogs in Ethiopia, these Muslim countries. And she could not believe the freedoms that she had in Holland. And within a very short period of time, she was educated and she entered Parliament. She became a politician in the Dutch government. And she fought for reform, spreading back into her country, reform for those poor people, those poor women subjected to all of those dreadful things. And... yeah, this is a very moving book. It's every time I think of her, I weep as to what people are put through. She wrote another book called The Caged Virgin, and I recommend both of these books to you. They are absolutely awesome reads. And here's another one, which again is a very compelling book by Mukhtar Mai, of a Pakistani woman, and it's entitled In the Name of Honour. And her 12-year-old brother was framed by the tribe next door. When I say the tribe next door, their houses were so close you could see them just down the road. And her 12-year-old brother was framed for having illicit sexual relationships with one of their girls. And so they held a tribal meeting. And the outcome of that was that she had to attend the tribal meeting and to restore their honour... they gang raped her and then tossed her out on the street with barely any clothes, and she was expected to go home and die, which is what their women do when they're raped. They're expected to go home and die. And her mother refused to buy her the poison or the wherewithal to end her life. And again, another poor girl who had absolutely no education, just kept in the dark, no schooling. She only knew what she knew of the Quran by overhearing others talking, and she memorised a lot of it. And she too ended up taking her case right through to the top echelons of power in Pakistan. And now she... sorry, that wasn't a very clever catch, was it? She goes and stands before kings and governments and United Nations and people all around the world, telling the story of the brutalities that happen in these regimes. So what we're going to do is look this morning at how this regime of Islam came about. and perhaps what its end may be in the Bible. But before we do that, I just want to show you a little 7-minute clip here of, it's called Psalm 83, and it's life, looking at life through Jewish eyes and the Bible in Psalm 83. And when you look at what is actually said here and quoted from the Bible, and the way that the Jews passionately believe what they believe, and then we look at it a little later on in the presentation, the Muslims and what they believe, we'll see why there is just so much conflict in the Middle East. Okay, go back to the beginning, try again. You all see that? They devise crafty schemes against your people, Psalm 83. They conspire against your precious ones. Yes, this was their unanimous decision. They signed a treaty as allies against you. Very interesting timeline, starting with the death of Jesus, the spread of Christianity with the blue. Hinduism and Buddhism was already present in the earth. Christianity grew around Europe and Northern Africa. The blue is Christianity, the green is Islam, growing. In the West, the Muslims fought Christianity. In the East, Christians fought Muslim. You've got the spread of Christianity then through the Reformation movement back in the 1800s and the Restoration movement. So here's that timeline sped up now. You see the rapid growth of Islam. Do to them as you did to the Midianites and as you did to Sisera and Jabin at the Kishon River. These are words which are very familiar to the Jews. They were destroyed at Endor and their decaying corpses fertilised the soil. Pretty strong language. Let their mighty nobles die as Oreb and Zeeb did. Let all their princes die like Zeba and Zalmunna. For they said, let us seize for our own use these pasture lands of God.
So you can see there's not a lot of love lost there. And that will provide a background now to what we want to share with you about Muhammad, the locust prophet. If I would ask you, where do you think Muhammad's mentioned in the Bible, where would you turn? Anybody think of a verse? He's not actually mentioned by name, and his religion is not actually mentioned in any great detail. But I happen to believe that the book of Revelation, which is of course a book of symbol, holds some information about the growth of Islam back in the 7th through to the 10th centuries. And particularly that information, I believe, is found in Revelation 9, verses 1 to 12, describing the fifth trumpet, which is also the first woe. My concept of the Revelation is that it is a continuous, unfolding historical progress of time from the time when Jesus delivered the message to John on the Isle of Patmos right down to our days and beyond. There are other views of Revelation, and over time, of course, I think all of our views of this very cryptic book of the Bible change as we grow in our understanding. I used to be very rigid in what I believed that the Revelation taught, but I'm a lot more fluid now. But for the purposes of this talk, we'll go with this material, which I did prepare some time ago. And the information that came to me was that the fifth trumpet, which is also the first woe, there are three woes, this corresponds to judgment on the eastern third of the Roman Empire back in the three centuries from 600 through to 900 AD. Picture of the world, you've got the western third of the Roman Empire, spoken of in Revelation 8 and verse 12, and there are indications there in Revelation 8 verse 12 of the activity of Attila the Hun and another raider by the name of Genseric, who plundered the Roman Empire from the borders, from the outside, and ultimately weakened the Western Roman Empire. That took place in AD 476 through to 493. Then there was what they call the Hellenized, or the Grecian Roman Empire. And when the Goths and Vandals had done their work in the western part of the Roman Empire, the seat of power moved from Rome across to Constantinople. And so Constantinople became what is known in history as the Second Rome. And then there was the eastern part of the Roman Empire, which is the part that we're going to be talking of this morning. And particularly we're going to be looking at that region way down in Saudi Arabia. And a period of time, AD 632. And the Bible says in Revelation 9 that there was a star having fallen from heaven. In the King James Version, it's in another tense, but in reality it is a star having fallen. We'll talk about it in that in just a moment. So reiterating that again, there was the Latin third, which was the western third of the Roman Empire, the Hellenic third, which was the central third of the Roman Empire, which was the old Grecian empire, and then the Hellenized third, which is where Islam took root. It's a bit faded, I'm sorry, but it says there in verses 1 to 12 of Revelation 9, it talks about judgment on the eastern third, that Hellenized third, of the Roman Empire. And the star, I believe, in Revelation 9 and verse 1, refers to Muhammad, the prophet king, or the prophet locust, or the locust prophet, I should say, of Arabia. It speaks in verse 1 of a key being given to him, and a key in Scripture is symbolic of dynasty building and preaching. Now, a lot of information I'm going to give you this morning is stuff that you can follow up for yourself later and check it out for yourself. The bottomless pit is literally the pit of the abyss, and we'll explain that in just a moment. In verse 2, there's a picture in Revelation 9 verse 2 of the pit having been opened, which I believe corresponds to Muhammad gaining power. and a great smoke coming up out of that pit. And the smoke perhaps being indicative of God's judgments being unleashed. The sun and the air were affected. In other words, here was a period of time where there was forced conversion for all. And of course, Muhammad, and then ultimately the caliphs who followed after him, the little mini kings, forced their version of religion, particularly on the Catholic, the Roman Catholic believers, or the systems that believed in a Trinity. And you were given a choice. If Muhammad or his caliphs come into town, it was become a believe in one God, Allah, or the sword. You had the choice. You could retain your belief in the Trinity, but you lost your head if you did. And so the sun and the air there probably speak of the influencing power of these hordes as they came across the Roman Catholic Empire and forced their religion on all. And verse 3 describes a plague of locusts. And we'll look at this in more detail in just a moment. Describing armies of men with cavalry, invincible, licentious, tormenting and destructive. And there's an absolute fitness to the Bible language. You can see that this is a picture of the Middle East and Africa, can't you? This is Africa. You've got the Mediterranean in here. And it says in Revelation 9:2 that there came up out of the pit locusts upon the earth. Now what is this talking about? Remember, John receives this vision on the Isle of Patmos. And from where he is looking in vision, out across the Hellenized third of the Roman Empire, if we were to draw the limits perhaps of the then known world across the top of north of Africa, coming down here because they knew about that part of the world, and then going across there, that for all the world looks like a pit in the ground, doesn't it? And from where John is looking in symbol, he's looking down into the pit, into Saudi Arabia. And it says of the angel that he opened the bottomless pit and there arose a smoke as of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke. Now, have any of you ever seen or been in a locust plague? Yeah, I have. In Western Australia we didn't have a lot of locust plagues, but I remember one particularly in 1992, a locust plague came through, and that's exactly what it looks like. The sky goes dark and it's just a wall of insects that take over the entire, you know, all the air and the ground and the grass. They even went to the extreme of painting their bowling greens in WA. They painted them red to try and fool the locusts into not eating the green grass. It worked because they're attracted to anything green. And so they painted their bowling greens red to stop the locusts from eating the grass. But you have to put screens up in your front of your radiator and you're driving your car and all this type of thing because there's just millions and billions and billions of these little insects. And they're a very apt description, I believe, for the hordes that followed and still do follow Muhammad. The plague locust has a breeding cycle of 5 months. And it's interesting, in Revelation 9, a period of 5 months is mentioned twice to do with the judgments of God. If we look at a 30-day month, which is the standard Bible month time, we're looking at 150 days for a plague locust breeding cycle. And it's mentioned twice in Revelation 9. So if we take that as a day for a year, which is a principle which we established in Daniel. Daniel quite often uses a day for a year to outline prophecy. We have in Revelation 9 a 300-year period where the locusts come wave after wave after wave, as locusts do, and that's exactly the period of time that corresponds to Muhammad and his successive mini-kings decimating the Roman Empire up until 933, a 300-year period. In verse 3, there are scorpions mentioned in Revelation 9. And a scorpion, of course, is a little insect that's got a sting in its tail. And there are Bible commentators who believe that that's a very accurate description of the Saracen fire, or the way that the Muslims were able to drag their artillery into battle with their horses. The cannon was facing behind the horse, and then when they got to where they wanted to bomb the walls or bombard the walls, they turned the cannon around, and then for all the world there was fire come out of the tail of the apparatus that the horses dragged. So they looked like scorpions, prophetically and symbolically. And the Muslim hordes used this Saracen fire to great effect to get what they wanted. Sorry about that darkness there. It says that the judgments came upon those that had not the seal of God. They weren't to kill or entirely wipe out everything. So the Eastern Roman Empire was not destroyed. It was simply subdued. Death fled. The empire survived despite pain. And these locusts are described as being like unto horses. We're going to look at that in just a minute. And the Muslim hordes had splendid cavalry. They're described as having crowns like gold, which aptly describes the trademark yellow turban of these hordes. Faces like men, right? Not clean shaven like women, bearded. They had hair like women though, long flowing tresses, as is their custom. Teeth as lions, so they were ferocious without mercy. And here we come to the part with the description of the locust. In Italian, the word for locust is cavalette, or little horse. And the shapes of locusts, it says in Revelation 9, were like unto horses. And the Arab says that the locusts have the thigh of the camel, the legs of an ostrich, the wings of an eagle, the breast of a lion, their tails like vipers, and the appearance of horns adorn their appearance. So that's the Arab description. Like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. So it's a symbol of this horde of, or masses of people, that swept up out of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, as we're going to see in just a moment, and overran the Roman Catholic Empire. Their faces were as the faces of men. The Saracen beard was a venerable sign of manhood. And on their heads were crowns like gold. I couldn't get a golden crown in that picture, but pick them there. All their turbans, and among the crowds there, the yellow turbans. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and they had stings in their tails. They had breasts of iron, says the description in Revelation 9. And so these hordes had armour and weapons of iron, which were characteristic of their armies in the 6th and 7th centuries. 5 months, we've mentioned already, twice used, symbolically talking about a period of 300 years. In verse 11, another king is mentioned, who is not the star, not Muhammad, mentioned in verse 1, but describes the caliphs who followed Muhammad, and described in verse 11 as the angel of the abyss. And the abyss there is Abaddon, and in Greek Apollyon, in Hebrew it's Abaddon, in Greek Apollyon. Primarily the Saracen judgments were to be against the Holy Land and the remnants of the Grecian Empire. And this is what locusts do. They breed 5 times per year. So they've got a life cycle of 5 months. They can breed 5 times per year, and each time they breed, they multiply their number anywhere between 5 and 10 times. So absolutely, once a plague of locusts starts multiplying and starts marching, they are unstoppable, just like the Muslim hordes were in the 6th and 7th century. And so an apt description, perhaps, of these hordes as they came up out of the pit of the abyss, came up against the Middle East, and came across here to Toulouse in France. And so for those 3 centuries, they worked their way across northern Africa and up into Western Europe in an attempt at world domination. In doing so, they pushed Christianity out of northern Africa. Just had that updated, you know. You think they would have gotten rid of that? They pushed Christianity out of northern Africa, and in an attempt at world dominion, they were heading around into Western Europe. But in the 10th century, they were stopped by the Christians at Toulouse in France. And so ended this first woe period of 300 years, dating from AD 632, Prophet Muhammad, to AD 933. Now the locust, the most major breeding ground for locusts in the world is actually in this region of the world. The Horn of Africa, down here into Saudi Arabia and around into the Gulf of Aqaba. Locusts often breed in the coastal plains of the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, rather, and the interior deserts of Yemen during the winter and spring, or at any other time if the conditions are right. And so they can have their eggs lying dormant in the ground for year after year after year until the conditions are right. When the conditions are right, boom, out they come. Very similar to the way that these people are working in the earth today, as we're going to see. There's a photo there of an actual locust plague on the move. Looks for all the world like smoke coming up out of the ground, doesn't it? National Geographic, in an article in 1915, says once entering a vineyard and the sprawling vines, this is about the locusts coming into a vineyard, and the sprawling vines would in the shortest time be nothing but bare bark. When the daintier morsels were gone, the bark was eaten off the young topmost branches, which after exposure to the sun were then bleached snow white. Then, seemingly out of malice, the locusts would gnaw off the small limbs, perhaps to get at the pith within. And so there they are at work in a field of corn, I would imagine. And once they move into a standing field, there's not much left when they go. That article goes on to say they stripped every leaf, berry and even the tender bark. They ate layer after layer of the cactus plants, giving the leaves the effect of having been jackplaned. Even on the scarce and prized palms, they had no pity, gnawing off the tenderer ends of the sword-like branches and diving deep into the heart, they tunnelled after the juicy pith. In the solitary phase, locusts are active, live and breed as scattered individuals. So they pose not a very big threat. They're relatively harmless. But in their gregarious phase, when they gather together as a group, they become extremely active and they acquire the habit of congregation and forming bands, breeding rapidly, and in the adult stage they fly long distances during migration, even over water, to get to where they want to go. Now, what's the background to all of this? Well, 1,500 years before Revelation 9, before Muhammad, remember the story in the Bible in 2 Chronicles 9, the Queen of Sheba came and paid Solomon a visit. And as a result of her visit and the information she got from King Solomon, she took home with her aspects of the Jewish religion. And we know that as late as Acts 8, with the conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch, that there were people still making pilgrimages from down in this region of the earth up to Jerusalem, and they were true to the Jewish faith. The Ethiopian eunuch, of course, being baptised by Philip on one such occasion. Coming right down to our own very own day, in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, some of you here would remember Operation Magic Carpet. Anybody know what that was? The Ethiopian Jews, who were entitled to go back to the homeland of Israel once it had been established. And so even today there are still people down in this region, though not as many as there were, because a lot of them have gone and immigrated back to Israel, who are there as a result of the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon nearly 1,000 years before Christ. Why do I mention that? Well, there's large aspects of the Quran which seem to be loosely based upon the Bible. I've read parts of the Quran. I can't stomach a lot of it. It's compared to what we read in the Bible, it is just so, I don't know what you'd call it, nebulous, pointless. It sounds to me like a collection of yarns gathered around campfires, which probably is how it happened. As these merchant traders, this is a great place for merchant traders travelling in the Middle East, the spread of Christianity, six centuries after Jesus or five centuries after Jesus, stories being swapped. And for all the world, some of the stories that are written in the Quran, particularly about the life of Abraham and different other notable Bible figures, just sound like what people might recollect after having probably had a drink or two around the campfire and shared a few yarns. And I believe perhaps that's where Muhammad got a lot of his information from, was from these people who had a Jewish connection, who were there 11, 12, 13, 1400 years after Queen of Sheba returned. There's a picture there of a cave near Medina. Medina, of course, is the capital city of that region, where Muhammad was supposed to have had visions from the angel Gabriel. None of us can test this. All we can do is accept his word for it. And he never wrote anything down in a book per se. He wrote stuff down on strips of bark, bits of bone, bits of stone, even on the backs of some of his followers. And so if anybody says to you, I want to see the originals of the Quran, there aren't any. There aren't any. It's just, it was written down on whatever was available at the time. Now Muhammad lived from 570 AD till 632 AD. His family looked after the shrine at Mecca, so they were involved pretty heavily in their religion. Muhammad travelled extensively throughout Arabia, and he married later in life, in his 40s, a widow of a rich merchant in Mecca. At 40, he had these conversations with the angel Gabriel, supposedly, and then declared himself to be the last chosen prophet. Pretty handy, because then you can relegate Jesus Christ to being just one of the other prophets. They do have a respect for Jesus Christ, but not a high one. They just simply regard him as a good man. He married a number of wives in his old age, and there is some thought that he possibly suffered from a form of bipolar disorder. The youngest that he married was a girl the age of 9. His life on the whole, says H.G. Wells, was by modern standards unedifying. He seems to have been a man compounded of very considerable vanity, greed, cunning, self-deception and quite a religious passion. The book he dictated, which finally became the Quran, when regarded as literature of philosophy, is certainly unworthy of its alleged authorship, says H.G. Wells. And yet for all that, here's a picture of one of the last pope kissing the Quran. And the Quran actually prescribes death to all who don't practice monotheism. So how incongruent is that? Absolutely amazing, isn't it? There's a picture of old Yasser Arafat there kissing the ring on the last pope's hand as well. So I'll just put those up there because Mohammedism and Catholicism were once implacable enemies. They fought each other to the death. That's what the Crusades was all about. That's what the push up into Western Europe for the Muslims was all about. One was fighting against the other the entire time. And so the Roman Empire was troubled from within for quite a number of centuries as a result of the activities of Islam. Now here's a picture of one of the Eastern religions and their worship of the moon, the crescent moon. This picture here is of a stained glass window in a church, in a Roman Catholic church in France, depicting the picture in Revelation 12. Come on in, sir, if you want to come, you're welcome. And in Revelation 12, there's a word picture of a woman clothed with the sun standing upon the moon. Now, obviously symbolic, it couldn't be literal. But what I put that up there for is there's a connection between these two religions, even though they are implacable enemies, couldn't stand the sight of each other, both of them have aspects of moon worship with them. You recognise those as being typical spires on mosques. You see them anywhere, and the crescent-shaped moon is part of their standard culture. Here's a picture of a little goddess, or a little god, that was dug up from a site in Saudi Arabia. The moon god, seen from all four sides, and the crescent moon carved on the chest. And there, of course, is some Islamic flags. What's common about them all? They've all got the crescent-shaped moon. So even though there is this implacable hatred that seems to go on between the Muslims and the Catholics, as I'm talking now in ancient history, because I think things have changed over the time, we've got what I've termed Occidental Universalism, which is Catholicism. I'm sorry you can't read that, it looks really good on my computer from here, but for some reason it goes dull when you put it up here. So Catholicism is Occidental Universalism. Catholic simply means a universal religion. Mohammedism is Oriental Universalism. In other words, trying to bring the masses together under one umbrella. Catholicism says the Bible is Babylon-based. It's a Babylon mystery religion. And Mohammedism, of course, had its origins in Babylon. Catholicism has a false Trinity God as its basis. Mohammedism has Allah as a false god as its basis. We've seen the pictures there of the sun and moon gods brought over from ancient paganism into Catholicism, and the same thing happened with the shrines in Mecca. I believe there were 350 gods that they worshipped, and the principal god was the moon goddess, and she has become Allah. They've changed the she to a he, and so that has become the principal god. Catholicism claims an infallible head in the Pope, and Mohammedism is treated as though Mohammed was an infallible head. Millions follow in Catholicism, as do Mohammedism. Anti-Semitic, as is Mohammedism. Heaven going at death, heaven and paradise with Mohammedism. Hell and purgatory, if you don't make it, a similar thing with Mohammedism. Both are based on legalism. Nikki and I watched a film a year or so ago of life in Afghanistan, I think it was, and there was a story of a girl and a boy, innocent, playmates, and the girl looked for all the world like she was a boy, she was pretty rugged, and she wanted to do the boy things, and she ended up going into some sort of fighting force, until they found out she was a girl. There's ways that they find out that they're a girl. And she was married off then to an ancient, you know, geezer up there in the scrub, somewhere he already had a multitude of wives. And they just showed his bathing ritual, you know, and what he did. You know, you've got to wash down this side three times, and wash down this side three times, and just in case you haven't got this side right, you've got to wash it three times. And it's all about crossing the I's, crossing the T's and dotting the I's and having everything absolutely right before God can look upon you with favour. And so both religions are based upon legalism. The use of war and fearful warriors in Islam. Barbaric in the past, the excesses of the Inquisition compare with the barbarism of Mohammedism. Ignorant, both of them, of the Bible to a large extent, they were. Food restrictions on both, immoral, plunder the masses, plunder the nations, world domination is their aim for both, deny Christ, and both of them engage in pilgrimages. So you sort of wonder why on earth these two enemies, which have so much in common, spent so much time fighting each other to the death. Well, perhaps that's all changing now, because Islam is on the move. And there's a picture of the influence of Islam right down here on the eastern seaboard of Africa, right across the top of Africa, all of this region up into the bottom end of Europe, where we had those terrible wars at the end of the 90s, Sarajevo and the like, right up here into the underbelly of Russia, right down here across into India, and of course right down here into Indonesia, which has the largest concentration of Muslims of any nation in the world, and they're right on our doorstep. Twice they've had a go at world domination. In the 9th century, they pushed across the top of Africa and were stopped at Toulouse in France. And in the 17th century, they pushed out of Asia Minor and up into Europe and were stopped at the gates of Vienna. And that frustrates the modern Muslim leaders. Twice they've come so close to having world dominion. And they believe that world dominion is their right. And so they are pushing today again for world domination.
Those of us who were at the conference would have seen that picture of the Islamic or the Muslim demographic, and how the population in the Western countries of Muslims is just growing and growing and growing faster than we can breed, because they breed like rabbits, or like locusts, I suppose.
The Bible in Jeremiah 25 verse 32 speaks of an evil going forth from nation to nation and great whirlwind being raised up from the coast of the earth. And you remember in Psalm 83, the Jews reflect upon this same phenomenon about a whirlwind in the last days going forth across the globe. And part of that whirlwind, I believe, was things like 9/11, which just captured the attention of the world in a majestic way, and the repercussions are still coming down through our own day. Sorry about the old pictures here, folks, but some of the faces from the past who represent the ideologies of madness, the Bible says in Revelation 16, working miracles, gathering the kings of the earth to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. So what is all this happening for? It's all happening to bring the world to a point where it will accept Jesus Christ as king. Pictures of little babies in Palestine dressed up with guns. Why? Because they see the Jews as being implacable enemies of theirs. Kids in kindergarten being taught blood songs and to kill their neighbours, the Jews. Look at what's strapped to it. Probably mock bombs, but they're still bombs, aren't they? Somebody once said, and I wonder how true it is, that every civilization that has practiced child sacrifice has been eradicated off the earth. There's a picture of Palestine with a sword through it and the Palestinian flag colours. Or should I say a picture of Israel with a sword through it. This was Osama bin Laden and a taped television broadcast in 2001. What America is tasting now is something insignificant compared to what we have tasted for scores of years. Our nation, the Islamic world, has been tasting this humiliation and this degradation for more than 80 years. In these days, Israeli tanks infest Palestine, in Jenin, in Ramallah, in Rafah, in Beit Jala. Names which we remember from last decade. I swear by God, he says, who has elevated the skies, thanks, without pillars, neither America nor the people who live in it will dream of security before we live in it in Palestine, and not before all the infidel armies believe the land of Muhammad, peace be upon him. And so they are determined to push Israel out from their country. In a book entitled Our Country Palestine, the author writes, there is no alternative to destroying Israel. Perhaps Allah brought the Jews to our land so that their demise could be here, as it was in their wars with Rome. In the same book it goes on to say, the Jews have no places left in Palestine they claim are holy sites to them, except the Wailing Wall. The Muslims permitted the Jews out of kindness and generosity to visit this wall. Yeah, right. As to what the Jews claim is theirs, houses of worship and cemeteries located in Palestinian territory, well, these are the properties of Christians and Muslims. And so there is a push to bring these two forces together, as we see in the next slide, against Israel. Palestine, the gift of the heavens to the earth, is today the subject of the heart's aspirations for Christians and Muslims, representing half the world's population, and the struggle waged in it is not between Muslims and Jews alone, rather it's between Christianity and Islam on one side and Zionism on the other. Quoting pages 9, 10 and 11 of that book noted earlier. Well, what does the Bible say? You can look this up for yourself, but in Genesis 16 verse 12, speaking about the future of Ishmael, who of course is reckoned to be the progenitor, the father of all the Arab nations, it says of him that he shall dwell to the east and on the borders of all his kinsmen. And it appears that the one that Genesis 16 describes as a wild ass of a man, whose hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him, will ultimately come to settle peaceably east of the River Jordan, over against their kinsmen, the Jews. And other passages of the Bible support that also. In Isaiah 60, "Arise, shine, for your light is come, and the multitude of camels shall come to you, the dromedaries of Midian and Ephah," names which we saw there referred to in Psalm 83 right at the beginning, "all the men of Sheba," which is down where Muhammad came from, "all the flocks of Kedar and the rams of Nebaioth shall minister to you, and violence shall no more be heard in your land." Just love Isaiah's beautiful, peaceful, graphic imagery of the future. In chapter 19, verse 23, "In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria." Where's it got to go? It's got to go right through the land of Israel. "And the Assyrian shall come down into Egypt, and the Egyptian shall go to Assyria, and they're going to pass back and forth through the land of Israel. And the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the earth." And so instead of Israel being what is seen by most or many people today as being a curse in the Middle East, the Egyptians and the Syrians, representing the Arab nations, I believe, and Israel are all going to be living peacefully together, having reconciled their differences. Hard to believe from this side, looking at it, but if we believe what the prophets have written, it will happen. And so in our final slide, all of these Arab nations, which are all Muslim to the core, surrounding little tiny Israel here on the eastern seaboard, or eastern part of the Mediterranean seaboard, Zechariah looks forward to the day when 10 men will take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, "We will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you." Thank you.